Affairs Democratic Talk Radio is sponsored in part by www.algoreisourpresident.com. AlGoreIsOurPresident.com is a sponsor of Democratic Talk Radio, not because the election was a close one, nor because Al Gore didn't prevail, or even because we are unhappy with the Republican administration, which we are. Rather, we are a sponsor because we believe Al Gore did win both the popular vote and the electorate. This rightful victory was denied, however, as the final tally of votes was circumvented by the Supreme Court when they halted the legal hand count, thus giving the White House to their own personal choice for president. Democracy was dealt a terrible blow. Our goal is a simple one, to be a positive voice for those who support our truly elected president, Al Gore, to share articles, full motion campaign video, some great downloads, and a few laughs, to help us remember our president and the positive things he would have worked so hard to accomplish for us. We also offer a full line of re-elect Gore in 2004 merchandise items to keep a future Al Gore presidential run both visible and tangible, like t-shirts, bumper stickers, pins, and much, much more to come. Please visit us at www.algoreisourpresident.com. Our website, as well as the Democratic Talk Radio website, was designed by Accent Design Studios, which can be reached at www.accentdesign.com. AlGoreIsOurPresident.com wishes to thank them and you for your support of our site and all Democratic efforts wherever they may be.
And welcome to Democratic Talk Radio on this Saturday. My name is Al Lawrence with my co-host Stephen Crockett, and we have a very special guest in our studios this evening. We have State Senator Lincoln Davis, who's running for the 4th Congressional District here in the great state of Tennessee. Welcome, Lincoln.
Al and Steve, thanks. Thanks for allowing me to be here. I just had a good meeting today at noontime with our executive committee meeting here in Lincoln County. And when I say Lincoln County, I really like this county, the name. Lincoln County.
Got a ring to it, doesn't
it? With Lincoln Davis.
Yeah, sure.
Hopefully, as the race opens up in this race for U.S. Congress, the U.S. House seat that I'm running for, not only the name will play well, but maybe the fact that I'm kind of like the folks here in Lincoln County will play up just as well.
And, Mr. Davis, how long have you been state senator for the state of Tennessee?
First time I ran for state senate was 1996. Annabelle Clement O'Brien, who's Frank Clement's sister, served since 1976. And in 1995, she came to me and said, I got a phone call one night, and she said, if you've ever heard me, Senator, she said, Lincoln? I said, yes. She said, this is Miss Annabelle. And I said, well, Miss Annabelle, how you doing? She said, doing well. I'm going to retire, and you're going to run for state senate. I said, Miss Annabelle, this is Lincoln Davis. Are you sure you got the right number? Well, from that, she convinced me and others did that probably I should run, and my children, three daughters, were already through school, and my wife consented that that probably would be okay, reluctantly, that I could run. And I ran for the state senate seat and won quite well. I carried five of the six counties in that area. There was a 16-year House incumbent that ran on the Republican side, and I carried all the counties except her home county, and in the area that's considered by many to be a Republican district.
So you have a very strong candidacy here in the county and or in the county and in this district, and I can frankly say that not really being all that involved in local politics, I'd heard your name long before I ever met you, and we met up in McMinnville last year, and I'd heard a lot of good things about you prior to this. So.
Well, I served in the Tennessee House back in the early 80s and ran in 1984 for the seat that Al Gore gave up when he ran for the U.S. Senate. Bart Gordon won that race. I came in second in that particular race. So I've been around for really not in politics a long time. I've only served less than 10 years in the legislature. In 84 through 96, obviously, for 12 years, I went back to home, did my business, had my farm operation, and do some construction work and some development.
Well, now you're running for the office that current Congressman Van Hillary now holds, and he is vacating that office to make his gubernatorial try for the state of Tennessee. Now, the person that's going to be your opponent is Janice Bowling, I think. Isn't that correct?
Well,
we're not sure yet.
Yeah, I don't have an opponent in the Democrat primary. My hopes are that we can keep the Democrat primary pretty much clear, that we don't have anybody running in that race. And on the national level, we've been there in Gephardt, Congressman Hoyer, who's actually recruiting candidates to run for the Democrats. And much of that is bordered on the South. And we've got a great deal of support from the DCCC, the Democrat Campaign Congressional Committee. And things look exceptionally well from their standpoint. They're saying at this point in time that they've got this elevated to where that's one of the top five in the nation. There's another congressional district in Alabama, and we are sharing today the number one spot. So in essence, the fourth district and the one in Alabama are considered one and two, or two and one, however you want to put it. We're going to say this is number one. And so things look exceptionally well. Democrats on a national level are excited. Democrats across Tennessee are excited. Al Gore's endorsed the campaign. And we've got others like Bob Clement, who got a fundraiser for him in his home in Nashville, gave a strong endorsement of the campaign. And what they're saying is that, you know, the time has come for us to elect a Democrat in the 4th District, and as a result of reapportionment and a result of the background that I have, I think that most folks are excited about this race being one that we will definitely win in November if I'm the Democrat nominee. So things look exceptionally well. We feel very comfortable where we are. And with the support that is for my campaign across the state, across the nation, I think we've got a great chance of taking Democrat values from this district to Washington and talk about education, the health care, and jobs for our people, economic development, and certainly national defense, where we have Redstone Arsenal and we've got the Arnold Engineering Center and Oak Ridge, three major installations that provides weaponry for our national defense.
So we get back to talking about issues that affect Tennesseans in this district and not just Republican issues. Talk about issues that involve every citizen here and not just Republican issues.
Well, I think what's happened in the past is you talk about those, and I'm not sure we want to go into that. The issues in the past have been guns and abortion and
right.
Family values. Well, nobody's going to outgun me. Nobody's going to outpray me. Nobody's going to outdaddy me. No one is going to do any more. No one's a better Christian than many of us Democrats are.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, what some folks have been ashamed to do is to say that. Well, I'm not ashamed of that. I'm very proud of that. It's my own personal commitment. It's not a political commitment. Unfortunately, we've allowed the Republicans to come in and demonize many of us who have a strong... my courage, my knowledge, and my strength comes from many parts of the scriptures, but one of the reasons that I think that Democrats do much, that I know Democrats do much better, if you read Matthew 25, 31 through 46, it tells the nations to attend to the needs of the oppressed, the sick, the elderly, the homeless, the hungry.
That's
what we do in this country, isn't it?
Right.
I mean, is that what we do? And Democrats have been the ones who brought those programs home into the bedrooms, into the kitchens, into the living rooms of our elderly and our children throughout this nation. So I'm not ashamed. I'm extremely proud of what we Democrats have done nationwide, of what we do in this district and what we've done in the state. It's an honor for me to be carrying the Democrat banner for us as we go into the elections in November.
Yeah, well, I think what I really think is strongest about your candidacy is that you actually are demonstrating the values that almost every Democrat in the nation has. You're just not letting them win the war of words, because that's what they've done. They've tried to make Bush Republicanism synonymous with Christianity without putting any Christian doctrine into it.
But you see, I don't have to defend the 10 Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court interprets those 10 Bill of Rights, and they tell us, through their interpretation of what the 10 Bill of Rights are, as to how it impacts us individually. Well, thank God for Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and others who fought very bitterly after the Articles of our Constitution were adopted, and then came back very shortly after and fought bitterly to get those. I think there's 11 or 12 at one time, initially 12. A third to 12, but only 10 of those passed by the states and ratified.
And they weren't initially in the Constitution.
Right. Actually, I don't believe the Constitution would be a great document without it.
It would not be without those and the others that have been added to
it.
But certainly those,
Republic,
I think, it would be a republic. Those 10 Bill of Rights give each of us as individuals a lot of choices that no other country allows their citizenry to have.
That's right.
Our Supreme Court then makes that interpretation. So when we talk about the issues of abortion, of guns, and others, there are seven members of our nine Supreme Court that is appointed by Republicans. Three of those by Ronald Reagan, the most conservative of all, we understand. Two of those was by George Bush, the daddy of the current president, mm-hmm. one by Nixon and one by Ford. Two of those appointed recently during the term of Bill Clinton. So when we talk about all these issues that the Republicans seem to have been able to try to demagogue and demonize Democrats on, it's their Supreme Court. It's our Supreme Court and their appointees that are making those decisions.
Exactly. Exactly. And what I want to point out to people, and we've talked about it often on the program, is that the Republican Party feeds a lot of lies about what Democrats are about. We are not the party that's going to take away your guns. I used to be an NRA member until they made a few little... Well, they basically became a political organization that was a tool of the Republican Party. The point that really got me is when they wanted to give convicted felons back their gun rights but weren't supporting giving convicted felons back their voting rights. I think their argument had always been that you should own guns to protect yourself. I don't think you protect yourself by giving guns back to convicted felons. That doesn't sound... This part of that NRA Republican ideology just frankly doesn't make sense.
Well, I love to hunt. I mean, I grew up at home. Coon hunting is one of the things we always did. My brother and I, after feeding of a night sometimes even before we did our homework, sometimes we didn't do our homework, but certainly before we did our homework many times, or left it undone, we go coon hunting. And we love squirrel hunting. We love to fish. Our father took us. When deers came in the area, I can remember when you couldn't find a deer. And one of the things, when we were NRA members back then, those when my father was an NRA member, one of the things that we got was called the National Rifleman. Mm-hmm. And through the 50s and through the 60s, there was a concerted effort to bring about restocking the whitetail deer in Tennessee, restocking the whitetail deer in the South, and restocking the turkey that we have. So in essence, the NRA has played a very important role in bringing about a lot of game. And they've been a major player of that. I think they need to get back to that more so because
Tennessee has a great game.
The NRA, when I was a member, was a gun safety and a conservation organization
and a sportsman's organization.
Right, and they really now. I blame the Republican Party for destroying a great organization.
Well, the NRA has been very favorable to me. I haven't had any. I mean, they've not attacked me. They've not taken me on. I think there are some Democrats that they support, and I've been one of those that's been blessed not to be opposed by them. And I think the reason is that I think they truly know and truly believe that I'm not out here trying to take law-abiding guns away from them. I have three daughters, two of which are married, and. When they were going to school, the younger two, they got to talk about, you know, some of the things that was happening, and they lived in an apartment there off campus, and there's a little gun, a little featherweight called the Lady Smith. It's a Smith & Wesson 38 5-shot. I bought them one for them to have, and they, my youngest daughter still has that. It's a beautiful little stainless steel gun. You can get them blued, stainless steel, or chromed, or whatever.
I used to have one, and even though it was Lady Smith.
It has Lady Smith written on the side of it, and she's, actually the day, she lives near Nashville, and I stay with her some when serving in the Senate, and I said, do you still have the little Lady Smith I got for you? And she said, yeah, Daddy, it's up in the closet, but I don't know where I can find it or not. And she lives by herself, and I said, find it. Not because it is something that you use offensively. It is something that you need. If you need to protect yourself, it's there and it's available. So I think that anyone who uses a gun in the commission of a crime ought to be punished severely. And I think the punishment ought to be greater for those who use a gun in the commission of an act of a crime. But to say that justifies taking everyone's guns away is not the way we should do it.
It's not going to happen either.
And that's also something that no Democrat that I know is supporting.
I don't know of any Tennessee Democrat does. Let me put it that way.
As liberal as they come, Steve knows me very well, and I'm a bleeding heart Democratic liberal from a city liberal. And let me tell you something. I don't want to take away anybody's gun except the criminals. I think American law-abiding citizens should have the right to have a weapon if they want to.
Well, I'm kind of a conservative Democrat, and like yourself, when I moved to Tennessee, we had a farm where we raised cattle and tobacco, and my father had a construction company.
Raising tobacco is tough, isn't it?
It's a hard way to make some money.
But it sure is awful good about Thanksgiving and right before Christmas when that check comes in, isn't it?
Yeah, I reckon. The checks aren't that big.
Well, the checks aren't that big, but
my
brother and I raised between 5 and 10 acres of tobacco usually every year, about 7.5 this year, and it really wasn't as good a crop this year. It was too dry, but it just didn't do well. We had 1 4-acre patch that did quite well. The other 3 that we had about an acre in each of those didn't do very well. The gun issue is something that really, if most people realized it, the Second Amendment says that we have a right to bear arms. Yeah. I mean, unless we change the Constitution, the gun issue doesn't even need to be on. I mean, it's not an issue that needs to be debated. It's a boogeyman that doesn't exist.
It shouldn't be a Republican.
And it says also this. It also says well regulated.
Yes.
Okay? Which means you have to address issues of gun safety and whether or not a person who's paranoid schizophrenic with homicidal tendencies has the right to bear arm. He doesn't.
There's no question. People who are mentally ill, or people who have had severe emotional problems in their past and continue to have those, owning a gun,
it's not a good thing.
It's probably responsibility. Yeah,
it's like a car.
We don't let people who drink a lot and are driving under the influence drive for very long without being sized with fine or a penalty, and ultimately taking away their rights to drive, even some permanently if they continue to break the law in that respect.
Sure.
So I think there perhaps are some areas where that we need to take a look at.
But most of this piece of legislation are already on the books. Very little I think needs done.
I think it's adequate. We need to leave it alone.
Just enforce it.
Leave it alone.
That's why I think that, like, our Republican governor Sunquist and those guys fall down on the job, and the Bush administration itself. Not that every time that there's a failure in law enforcement, they want to pass new laws instead of fixing the failure in law enforcement. And I think Attorney General Ashcroft is a great example of this. I do want to disagree one thing with Al. I don't think that the strongest opponent you're facing is the person, the Hillary staffer. I actually think Mark Green might be a lot more.
Mike Green. Well, Mike Green, who serves currently as the Commissioner of Safety, probably is a better recognized name across the district than Janice Bolden. Both of those are going to be running, my understanding, in the Republican primary. The thing about Green, he's from up in Murray County, would probably have maybe about the same base county-wise. The lady that's running against him, or he running against her, is from over in Coffee County and having served. But either of those obviously would be a formidable opponent. But the good thing about the 4th Congressional District is that it's a good rural district.
Yeah.
It's one that the people who live in this area, the majority of those, probably 85 to 90%, can drive within 5 to 10 miles and say grandpa or grandma or great grandparents are buried over there in that cemetery on Decoration Day. So in essence, the people who live here are from here.
Right.
Born and raised here. Many of them have farm backgrounds as I do. Many of them have worked in the factories. Their mothers or fathers, and many of the children, the grandparents, have worked in local factories and farmed at the same time. So in essence, my background parallels the background of virtually every person who lives in the 4th District. And many of those traditionally have voted in the Democrat primary.
Right.
Few of those voting in the Republican primary. So in essence, I think in this district, people want to vote for a Democrat.
Yeah.
I'm that Democrat that will give them what they want, to bring the values that they have into their homes, serve in Congress the same way that they would serve if they were elected to Congress, and look at the issues as they would look at the issues, and be someone who can articulate their position very forcefully in Washington. And so far, things seem to be working quite well, and everyone seems to be excited about my campaign. I want that to continue, obviously. I don't want to see an easing up on that. I've been out there early. Somebody said the early bird gets the worm. Well, I agree with that. So I've been the early bird. I'm getting the worm. The second mouse gets the cheese. So if there's somebody that wants to get in this race, I want them to be up there trying to get the cheese. I'll pick up the cheese after they don't get caught.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping in this race that it stays as it is, that we have an unopposed Democrat primary in August, and then go into November without having to spend a great deal of money, and being able then to express my positions that I have, which are the positions of the people of this district. And let our people know, let the voters know, that here's a candidate who shares your values, who shares your hopes, who's raised a family like you, who has grandchildren that he loves that calls him Paul, and loves to go fishing with him or squirrel hunting. It's ironic that a little 6-year-old and a 4-year-old granddaughter would want to go squirrel hunting me just as much as my 6 and 11-year-old grandson. But if I don't take them, when I take the boys, they get extremely hostile and irritated at me. And my youngest granddaughter, it was on the front porch last fall when I took the 3 older ones and stood out there for about 30 minutes calling them, "Paul, where are you?" And when I got back, she looked at me kind of puzzled-like and a little bit angry, and I said, "You didn't take me." So I've not made that mistake again.
The district that you represent as a state senator, how many counties are in that?
Actually, of the total population that I represent, either now or in the new district that I have Campbell County, I represent Pickett County, in the Tennessee House, and used to live there. So I've got Campbell County in the Senate District. I have Roan, Morgan, Scott, Fentress, and Cumberland counties. They're a portion of this new congressional district that's been redrawn. And the 4th District is a new district. There was 22 counties in it. We now have 24. 9 of those counties nine of those counties that was in the district of the 22 is no longer in, and 10 new counties came into the 4th district. So we virtually have a completely new congressional district. All the East Tennessee counties, with the exception of those in my Senate district, are no longer in the 4th district. And we picked up, we lost Wayne and Hardin counties to the west of us, and picked up Lewis, Hickman, and Murray County, which makes those three counties are traditionally pretty strong southern Middle Tennessee Democrat counties. And then we picked up the areas along the plateau. Currently, the entire Cumberland Mountains, or counties that touch it, in the Cumberland Mountains, are in the new 4th district. We picked up Van Buren, Marion, Grundy, Bledsoe, and Squatchie. All those except for Marion County was in the 4th district when it was initially drawn in 1982. And then Morgan County was in the 4th. In the 92 reapportionment, those five counties were taken out and put into the 3rd district, and then we picked up Wayne and Hardin counties. We've receded back into the 4th and made it a somewhat more compact district, and that's what most folks wanted. They wanted a more compact district,
right,
and one that wouldn't be stretched all the way from the other side of Morristown and up into Virginia, all the way down to Crump, Tennessee, to McNairy County across the Tennessee River. So what we've done is actually shortened the width of it from one end of the district to the other by about 125 miles.
Border.
Well, it was. It actually was touching the Mississippi border, yep. And we now have it to where that it's two counties away. So it's we've made the district, even though we've made the district more compact. Everybody was a player. For instance, in East Tennessee, you have three Republican districts, and to my knowledge, not a single Democrat drew a line in those three East Tennessee Republican districts. They were able to draw the lines as they chose.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence,
this reapportionment is much cleaner then.
It's a whole lot cleaner. It's probably the cleanest reapportionment. And, you know, the Republicans are hollering and say, well, the 4th district is it's been a Republican district.
But
Van Hillary's represented them, and, you know, so therefore we think we can win it. We put our database together, quite frankly, and our database kind of tells a story that if you're in the 4th district, you're in a good Democrat district.
And I think grudgingly that they would admit that, you know, that it did kind of help them anyways a little bit. You know, granted they might not have liked it much because they probably lost it, that they're feeling that they're losing out something, but it also strengthened them in some areas that I'm sure that they're pretty happy with.
I don't think the National Republicans will ever admit that the 4th district is going to be won quite strongly this time by a Democrat in November. I think they're going to keep saying, oh, but we can still win it, we can still win it.
Yeah, well, sure.
Well, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a money back guarantee they ain't going to win it.
Well,
it's not going to happen in this race.
I do hope that. Well, I'm sure the National Republicans are going to pour a lot of money in here, and I hope that some of our listeners out there who listen to us through the Internet, through our website, www.democratictalkradio.com, would consider maybe helping match some of that out-of-state money to you.
Well,
where would they send it to?
P.O. Box 2002, Powell Mountain, Lincoln Davis for Congress Committee, P.O. Box 2002, Powell Mile, Tennessee, 38577.
Well, don't be surprised if you get a check or two from
that sounds,
far off places.
Sounds good to me. Well, we've already received some money from outside the area. For instance, what happens on the national level, and I'm not familiar with all the things that happen on the national level. As a matter of fact, this is the first time I've ever gone to Washington to talk about this race, or any race that I've ever run, and generally have said I won't take PAC money. I've never taken PAC money in any, when I ran for Congress in 84 and 94. I didn't take any PAC money. I just didn't do that. I thought the people who elect you ought to give you dollars. Well, that's not the way it works anymore. The Republicans and Democrats both send a lot of money into different congressional districts. The DCCC, which is the Democrat Campaign Congressional Committee, has targeted this district, and I think I said this earlier, as one of the top five in the nation, one of the top two in their opinion. And what they're telling their folks who raise money, send it to
send
these
it
two or three or four or
yeah.
five seats.
Yeah.
Because we think we've got good candidates. We think we have candidates who knows the heart and soul of the voters in their district and will represent their constituents as well, and they'll be someone who will continue the tradition of what Democrats have done. Health care, for instance. Social Security. I don't know this is a fact, but I understand very few, if any, Republicans voted for the Social Security Act in the U.S. House of Representatives when it was passed under the Roosevelt administration. That speaks a lot for our Democrats. Maybe it speaks a lot for the Republicans too, but it certainly speaks a lot for Democrats.
The Republican Party's been quietly fighting the Social Security system ever since its inception.
Well,
it's trying to privatize it, and I believe that's an effort to destroy it.
Well, let me tell you something. I know a lot of people in the district I represent without Social Security
would have nothing.
Wouldn't be here,
right,
because
right.
their existence would not be.
Right.
They'd starve to death. So when we talk about Social Security being something that the Republicans or Democrats, the Democrats are the ones who kept Social Security
and
where it
right.
is today, and we're the ones who will keep it where it will
that's,
be in the future.
And that's
right.
very important.
It's extremely important that we understand that. And when you talk about Medicare, Duck Paste in the mid-60s, those were Democrat initiatives. Do you like it or dislike it? Ask the person who's receiving the benefit from it. They'll tell you they do.
And you can look at exactly what the Republicans have tried to do when they're trying to privatize. Could you imagine if you had your money, your Social Security money, the portion that you could put into private investments in Enron stock?
Well, it's not just that. But let's there are a lot of Democrats today, and Republicans and Independents as well, in the last decade and prior to that, has made a little bit of money, not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But if I'm putting if a person who earned $50,000, $75,000, or $100,000, and if you're self-employed especially, you're talking about putting a sizable contribution into the Social Security system. If you had an 8 or 10 year period where you made $50,000 to $75,000 as a self-employed person, and that's a big income now. Not a whole lot of people earn a whole lot, but there's some who've been blessed to do that, and more in the 4th District, for instance, than maybe was there 20 years ago. But if you allowed me to take that 15.3, is that what it is that we pay self-employment tax, including Social Security as well as, mm-hmm. as my Medicaid contribution, you allow me to take that and put it into the stock market in 1993, do you think I'd have put it in Social Security if I don't know what's going to be coming over the next 10 years? I wouldn't have put a single cent in Social Security. So what would have happened, those of us who were fortunate enough to earn more would have put it someplace. Now we may lose it all. If it's right. in there. It may have been an Enron stock, so we may have lost it all. Right. But on the other hand, what we've done is bankrupted Social Security, and the people who couldn't do that, who had no choice, and our elderly would be without Social Security benefits
the
as well.
So
there's a real, really, really, really big hole when we start talking about
And the Republicans also
messing with Social Security. We've got it perfected. Let's leave it alone.
Right. The Republicans also try to make Social Security a savings program, and it's not. It's a tax. It's a tax for one generation, pays for the older generation. Because for it to be a savings program, people would have had to pay into it for 20 years before they started taking any money out.
Yeah.
And it didn't. They were paying money out the first year.
Well, we don't. Even more than Social Security, if you look at the area through here, you've got Alabama and Mississippi and Tennessee and Georgia and Kentucky. With that TVA, where would we be? I mean, think about it. Well, yeah, I'm sure we would have continued to progress a little, but we've been behind the rest of the nation for years.
Right, that's
We're
right.
catching up now, and right. some many areas we're going way beyond where the other parts of the nation
TVA
are.
TVA was a Democratic.
One of the reasons I
TVA was a Democratic initiative, and any of those anything you want to look at today, whether it's Rural Electric Administration, which provided in the 40s and 50s and 30s dollars to be used to put rural power lines up. Power lines. I guess I better say that right. Sometimes I revert back to my Scotch-Irish accents of the dialect of Chaucer and Shakespeare, and I get to talking different than most people understand my language. But if you think about where we are today because of TVA, the electric co-ops, the telephone cooperatives that brought communications into our areas, the funding for those was provided by a Democrat Congress and a Democrat presidential initiative. Anything that you wanted to, public schools. Now, you know, the Republicans say, oh, we're for that too, but I can show you old school buildings that have rotted down in the area I'm from.
As a conservative just recently said, Lincoln, a good, mature, capitalist economy is a government project.
Well, without public education, either in our colleges or in our K-12, a lot of us will not have an education today.
That's right.
What were you telling me about those? Bill just wrote it down in East Tennessee.
Well, if you, I can places like Helena, that was a church, a funded school. You can drive through the Cumberland Plateau, that was an area of Appalachia, and many of the churches, Presbyterians, Baptists, Methodists, came into the area and actually built the schools there. And if you were affluent enough, you could pay a small amount, or if you had transportation, you could go to the schools. Well, if you didn't have anything except a horseback or wagons to ride on through the 20s and 30s, you basically then you were not given an opportunity to get an education.
Right.
But after the 1929 stock market crash, the economy that just undercut the girding of our economy, the contributions to keep those schools afloat dissipated. You can look at those school buildings. One in Cumberland County that comes to mind, I think, was built in 1918 and closed in 1936. Was no longer in existence.
Couldn't survive.
And so what happened is that it became a public school, and ultimately just it was closed. It's now opened back up as a public facility where they train people who are mentally handicapped or physically handicapped to actually go into maybe for home for child care or for other type of assistance to elderly or children. So when you look at those buildings, you realize that the funding for those dissipated and we no longer could get an education. Alvin York, for instance, when he built York High School in Jamestown, where I went, made this statement. He said, I dedicated it in the 1920s after raising monies all across America to build a high school. He said, I dedicate this building to the children of Pall Mall and the mountainous people of Fentress County so they can enjoy the liberating influence of an education which was denied me, and asked the American public to perpetuate its continued existence. So in essence, to him in the 20s, someone who didn't have an education, who did not have a chance to have an education, but yet he went on in World War I, in 1917, 1918, and became recognized as one of the greatest heroes, certainly from this state, and one of the most decorated foot soldiers in the history of our fighting men. So, and this man didn't have an education, but he realized what an education could do for you.
It is the fabric that weaves through the entire American lifestyle. The public school system is the fabric that runs through our American culture. It's one of the most fundamental things that we can provide our citizens on an equal level.
One generation without an education makes us a third world country.
That's right.
It makes us non-competitive.
And we were a third world country until we got it.
You're exactly right.
And when we get
to the point to where only the affluent can send their children to school, you know, I didn't go to Vanderbilt for a reason. I'd love to. It's a great school. I went to Tennessee Tech because I could afford to go there.
Right.
I didn't go into Oxford probably because I'm not smart enough, but I didn't go to Oxford because I couldn't afford to have gone. I didn't know where it was.
I got into Princeton, and I couldn't go.
So, you know, when we talk about public education, Tennessee Tech gave me a good education. I majored in agronomy and agriculture. Would I change my major? I love it, but I might have looked at something differently. I doubt it. But I had an opportunity. I didn't go to the University of Tennessee for a reason. It was an extra 75 miles from home. And I didn't have a way to get there. I could hitchhike to Tennessee Tech. Mm-hmm. And I lived off campus because it was cheaper. I walked about a mile and a half, which is not a great distance, across town from Cookeville over to Tennessee Tech on the other side of town. It's a wonderful school to go to, just as Middle Tennessee here and our community college, Motlow State Community College and others that we have, whether it's Columbia State, whatever. But we've changed even from 1962 when I got through school. There were no community colleges for us to attend, and there were no technical schools that we have. So in essence, what Tennessee's done is put a technical school or a community college within almost walking distance of virtually every child, man, woman, or child who wants to go on to get an education in this state. Is that good? I think it is. Should we continue? I think we must. Do we allow vouchers and charter schools to come on the scene where it eventually destroys our public educational system?
That eats away at the average person's ability to have access to an education.
What we must do, and I think most teachers will agree with this, is perfect the method of accountability. Have we perfected that yet? Probably not. Do I think we have? I don't think we have. But I think we're doing a better job in Tennessee than most states.
Well, I agree.
Yeah, I agree. Although
the direction's right.
Although there's a funding problem.
But accountability doesn't need to be used as a political method to get rid of enemies.
Right.
So in essence,
if we look at accountability as being a way of improving our education and helping teachers realize where they may improve. And now, you're talking to Phil, who has a wife that teaches, a daughter that teaches, and a son-in-law that teaches, who agrees that accountability is something that we must perfect. I notice now where I listen to TEA messages on local radio stations saying, we've done this in Tennessee by improving the reading skills of children in certain areas and all across. I mean, I think it's wonderful when we live in a state that says there's no child that'll be left behind. In Tennessee, we've tried to do that. We've even written that in our Constitution. It says it's the state's responsibility to provide equal access and equal opportunity to every child in this state.
And the state's been trying to do that, too, especially with some of the recent laws that have been passed about equalization for as far as teachers' pay in rural areas, that sort of thing. You know?
Living in one of the most affluent neighborhoods doesn't necessarily mean that you should be entitled to a better education than those who live in the most poverty or rural sections of our state.
The courts in Tennessee and many other places in the country say that you have to equalize spending
for
education.
Well, I think in this state we do, because we literally say in our Constitution, that is part of our Constitution, it is the state's responsibility to provide equal access and opportunity in education for every child.
And it should be.
It should be. You're exactly right. And if we start looking at a way to take the dollars that we have and siphon those off to go into the private sector. Some folks call it competition. Well, if in fact it's competition, then why don't we require them to have the same accountability standards of the public school system.
Exactly.
So, but in most charter schools, we don't.
And if you don't, then what's the point of having them?
We shouldn't. What happens is it gives the more affluent an opportunity who can subsidize their child's education, additional funds.
And it also gives them a way to also do things that the Constitution wouldn't allow you to do with a public school.
Well, I think
politicize
them. I think that most Republicans and most Democrats and most independents who don't call themselves anything realize that a public school system is one of the best
it's absolutely vital.
It has to continue.
Absolutely
I think Republicans,
vital.
All of us agree with that. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some who run that call themselves, I don't know what they are, but
they call themselves conservatives, but they're not.
Well, I don't know what a conservative or a liberal is.
I think
if
it sounds like to me it's just wrong.
If taking an opportunity away from a child to get a good education, being a conservative, I'm not.
Yeah. Well, you got to want to conserve something, not destroy stuff, to be a conservative. Yeah.
Well,
and conserving the great deal is still a conservative thing. Ronald Reagan conserved the great deal.
Reagan probably did more for the Republicans, to be honest with you, in bringing them back to an area where that the dialogue and the debate of being what's called a conservative was something that they could sink their teeth into.
Right, and the Bush administration has turned their back on it. You know, the alternative minimum tax on corporations, the current Bush administration is trying to do away with that as part of their economic stimulus plan, and several other ways they've tried to sneak that through. That was a Ronald Reagan legacy. He guessed that because the largest company in America, General Electric, at the time, was paying zero in federal income tax.
Well, also Reagan had kind of gotten away from the issues of Republicanism being completely on the side of big business. He kind of took the Republican Party away from that a little bit.
A little more populist.
Right,
and Bush has taken it back.
Populist.
So my opinion, these guys are really more, and Hillary's one of them, is really, they're big business fascists more than they are
conservatives.
Or Tennessee conservatives.
Well, in Tennessee, what we've always done, I think if you look at the Southern Democrat Party, and I don't want to say there's a Southern and that there's a National Democrat Party, but if you look at those who served in Congress from the South, they're the ones who passed the TVA legislation. They're the ones, because of their longevity in Congress, their seniority on both the House and Senate, are the ones who passed the Social Security Act. They're the ones who passed much of the legislation that we all look to today as being something that has been great for America. So when we talk about Democrats, we need to talk about those Democrats who have made a tremendous difference in our lives. And our opportunities, our options.
Democrats that were in the civil rights actions back in the 60s had a fundamental influence and a fundamental impact on that legislation even being passed.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to take those, let's discuss. Jimmy Carter's written a book called An Hour Before Daylight. And it talks about his state Senate race in 1962 and how he ran. It talks about, for instance, in Georgia, after the Civil War, many of the states in the South, Tennessee was not necessarily one of those, but many of the states in the South simply refused to ratify the required amendments.
Right.
And until they did, the Confederate veteran could not get his voting rights back. And so many states like Georgia and Alabama and others waited until about 1870 before they actually ratified the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just waited. They wouldn't do it. And the legislatures then eventually ratified those amendments, and every Southern state had to do it because that was part of the deal.
Yeah.
And then what happened? They could run again for public office. They immediately ran. Then they started setting up laws, election laws that made it difficult for anybody except the rich white man to vote.
Right.
As Carter was saying, he said, "In my home county," which was a smaller county than certainly the county around Atlanta, when you ran for governor in Georgia pre-1962, you ran and actually had to get delegate votes. The popular vote meant nothing. You could lose a popular vote 3-1 and still win it if you won a delegate vote. So each little county had its two delegate votes. And the bigger ones like Atlanta had maybe four. I think they eventually gave them 8 delegate votes to vote for the governor. It's kind of like the Electoral College, except we base ours on population per state and based upon the number of members that we have in the U.S. House.
Political power.
Yeah, well, it's based upon how many members we have in the U.S. House. One reason we have 11, we have, 9 congressmen and 2 U.S. senators. So we base ours upon population, which would be our representation that we have in the Congress. Georgia did the same thing, except it wasn't on population. It was based upon counties. So in essence, until 1962, from 1800 or something, until from 1870 until 1962,
So they counted the votes of the delegate to find out who won.
Well, one man.
Sure they did. And then they controlled who could register and vote. If you didn't, you had to pay a poll tax, you had to be a property owner. There's certain things that happen that you just, the laws that was passed in the South said you've got, it was so restricted to where, even until 1820, women couldn't vote in this country, remember?
1920.
Right. Women couldn't vote in this country. So, I mean, we've come a long way in the last 70 or 80 years. And I think,
still amazes me to this day, too, by the way.
Well, I mean, it does me. As a matter of fact, my Senate district has Roane County in it, and it was a House of Representatives member from there who actually voted. He was Republican. They thought he was going to vote. He actually was the deciding vote. They wouldn't need one more vote, and he was going to vote against it. His mother sent a telegram and said, "You do the right thing, son." And he interpreted that as meaning, "You better vote for that ratification," which he did.
Listen to his mama. Good.
Yeah. So as we look back to history, we see a lot of things that have changed. I think, obviously, as you talk about the civil rights legislation, the passage of the civil rights and voting rights legislation, I think every person who lives in this country ought to be afforded the right to vote without having stumbling blocks they have to go over.
Right.
Without a poll tax and these sorts of things. I mean, if you're a citizen of this country,
you have to have the same kind of access that anybody else has.
That anybody has. Especially voting.
And in the 21st century, we need to make sure that not only do you have the right to vote, but you have the right to have your vote counted.
I agree with that.
And I hope you'll do something about that when you're in D.C.
Well, we've done a pretty good job in Tennessee of being sure that there's a safe, secure, and definable way to vote and count the votes in Tennessee.
Yeah, we still have a little work here to do. Mostly not on laws being passed, but making sure that, again, that they're enforced fairly and equally.
Well, we've been talking to Mr. Lincoln Davis, State Senator Lincoln Davis, who's running for the 4th Congressional District here in the state of Tennessee. And we have just about used up all of our time.
We have a few minutes.
We still have a few minutes, and I just wanted to ask Mr. Davis, after the primaries are over and you should win your seat in the Congress, what are some of your first plans once you get the seat?
You know, probably what I'll do is open, obviously, district offices across this district. And something that no one's ever done is had an office in the smallest county and the largest county. I think perhaps we will have one definitely in the largest county and perhaps maybe the smallest, and it may be south of one person or something. But we will set up those offices. We'll use most of the money that they allocate us to have offices in the district and have staff in the district working. I think there's two things you have to do as congressman. Obviously, as a congressman, I've got to read, study, listen to the debate, the dialogue in Washington, legislation that is impending that will be passed, budgets that will be voted on. I've got to really, in my opinion, become very knowledgeable on what's going on in that area. But there's another part of being congressman, too, and that's helping the constituents that you represent. If they have a problem with the federal government, whether it's a Social Security problem, whether it's a problem with water or sewer in their area that maybe a congressman could help find some grants for, and economic development. So in essence, I'll have people working on my staff that will be helping cities, counties, elected officials, individuals, communities find help and maybe have hope as a result of me being the congressman. Now, having said that, when we talk about what will I be doing, I think most congressmen try to do that. I don't think anyone will do a better job than we will. I'll be staffing my office not with necessarily Harvard graduates and Princeton graduates, where you said you might could have gone at one time, Steve, but
couldn't afford it.
But what I will be doing is staffing with people just like us who will understand that when somebody walks into that office, or a letter's written, or a phone call is made, that they're not waiting for 6 months. 6 weeks or 6 days for an answer.
Or how much they might have donated.
Or how much they might have donated.
Or who they might work for, or what their political ties are.
Or whether Democrats, Republicans, or independents.
That's right.
When I get elected, I'm going to be voting on issues that most of our Democrats would vote on, such as protecting Social Security, being sure economic development is there, that we have health care for our seniors and for our children, that we have a good educational opportunities for, and they have a strong national defense.
That's what I love about the Democratic Party, you guys. The Democratic Party is for the average person.
You're exactly
right.
For the
John Q. public out
there.
Right. The guy that carries a lunchbox, even the guy that carries a briefcase, he's still an average person, and the Democratic Party is looking out for your interest, whether you make $20,000 a year or $80,000 a year.
And unfortunately, that message has not resonated with people who ought to appreciate the Democratic Party
right. Because
of the gun issue, the prayer issue, and the abortion issue.
That's right.
You know, the Bush's tax plan benefits primarily those who have a taxable income, annual income of about $600,000. That's where the guys really got the break. And I don't know too many people in this district who make $600,000 taxable income.
If you happen to find them, if they'd like to give to a congressional candidate, let me know who they are. Or if you're out there and listening to this, please send money. I gave the address a moment ago. I'm not sure we can do this politically, but that address, again, is Lincoln Davis for Congress, P.O. Box 2002, Pall Mall, Tennessee, 38577. Now, when we talk about Pall Mall, I mentioned Alvin C. York a moment ago.
Right.
Sergeant York. Movie made of him.
Decorated soldier in World War One.
And after he came back, I didn't know the soldier, but I knew the Christian philanthropist that he was. Tremendous individual. Gracie York, his wife, and Grandma Davis were sisters. So there's some kinfolk connection with his children and with his wife, so I'll claim him as my great-uncle through marriage, I guess, is the way they say it here in the South. But growing up there and having gone to school at Frogs Chapel Elementary, which is a one-room log schoolhouse still standing, and still used for church on Sunday, and sometimes on Wednesday night, and for revivals through the summer months, and then later going to Pall Mall and then to Alvin C. York Agricultural Institute at Jamestown, I realize the value of growing up in a rural area. I realize the value of the family unit. I realize the value of friends. And I realize the value of people such as Sergeant York and others who dedicated their lives to helping others.
Public service.
And public service, whether it's as a political figure
or
a private individual, is something that all of us ought to be more involved with. And when we talk about serving as a Democrat or Republican, and I've got a lot of Republican friends and supporters, so I'm not pulling the finger saying you guys are bad. I think most Republicans are just like me. I think most Democrats are just like me. They want to be, I don't say left alone, but they want to be allowed to enjoy the liberty and freedom that this country guarantees them, and educate their kids, have a decent job, have a good road to drive to work on, feel safe in their homes at night without worrying whether or not someone's going to come in and harm them, and being sure that we have a strong national defense. So, but unfortunately what we've done, after we talk about those issues, unfortunately what many Democrats have done is they've tried to debate the issue of some value of gun control or some value of other social issues, and prayer. Well, I'm glad I can pray anywhere I want to here, right now, if
right.
I wanted to.
You can pray anytime you want.
I think that's something we ought to be doing more of. We ought to be explaining to our children how they can pray in school.
Right, and not telling that they can't pray in school, because that's just not true.
I get really frustrated when I'm sitting in the as a parishioner and the pulpit has been occupied by a preacher, and he doesn't do it but once if I'm in the church, and he says you can't pray in school anymore. I sometimes tell him, say, wait a minute, yes you can, because my children did every day.
Right.
They told me they did. So don't tell me you can't pray in school anymore. Now you can't impose your will on others.
Teacher and administrators can't lead to prayer.
But Christ didn't impose his will on us. He gave his life so that we could accept him. So these issues resonate well with voters and the person who they think is the most powerful in many cases, or the most that will protect their rights for guns and other social issues. Generally, if you get past those issues, then the Democrats are the one who wins.
Right. Well, see, the Republican
One of the bottom line is, though, if people really knew the facts, the Republicans wouldn't win on those issues anyway.
Because
the Constitution guarantees it. There have been no laws changed in this country that changes. No congressman or no Congress, no senator or no U.S. Senate has passed a bill to reverse any of those decisions, and the Republicans control Congress from 94 currently through the U.S. House, and from 94 through 2001 until Jeffers changed over in the U.S. Senate. So, and that's, but nothing, there was no legislation introduced that would change all of those issues that the Republicans have been able to win on. So true Republican out there and the true Democrat and independent, here's a candidate named Lincoln Davis that has your values in heart and will work as strong for you as any Republican or any other Democrat will to be sure that we have those choices and that the 10 Bill of Rights, I will never vote to change the 10 Bill of Rights. So in essence, that's all you want to hear, is that I'm not going to infringe on your individual rights by going to Washington and becoming someone who's going to champion changing those constitutional rights that we have, our constitutional amendments.
And I don't know any Democrats who are advocating that anyway.
I don't either.
I guess
I'm being selfish by saying me. I'm telling you, if you're listening to this, Me, I am not going to do that.
You can speak for yourself. Right?
Yeah.
Now, I do want to say...
And I don't know if other Democrats, if there may be some that are, but I'm sure some Republicans are probably not, some of the Republicans may not be happy with their representatives either.
You know what, just as a closing note here, I'd really like to say it'd be really nice for a change to have a congressman who represents main small town, Main Street, instead of like our current congressman who represents Wall Street.
Well, I can guarantee you one thing. I guess Wall Street's up there, but we don't have a street named like that in our area. Most of our streets are Main Street because the towns are not big enough have except just about one or two streets on it, but the main street in town is usually the main street. So you got
right.
The ones that run. I'll be representing Main Street.
That's what we want to hear.
Main Street, 4th Congressional District.
Lincoln Davis, thank you for taking the time to come by and talk with us here on Democratic Talk Radio. It's been a pleasure, and we would love to have you back again before and after the election, of course.
It's good to be here. What I, you know, when I say Main Street, most of the people don't live in the incorporated areas, so, but I'm also going to be representing very strongly Country Roads.
There you go.
All right. Those roads with numbers on them, right?
With numbers on them.
That's right. All right. My name is Al Lawrence. We're for my co-